Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, this is quite the week. As you mentioned, as we were talking earlier, it's 5 minutes to midnight, the famous doomsday clock, or boys to girls song, as I seem to recall. But we got a deal coming down with Iran. We got the potential for war coming down between Russia and Ukraine. We have the Conference of Presidents, which is, after a two-year hiatus, is now holding its conference once again in Jerusalem. And you have all the ministers and prime minister, foreign minister, etc., who are all appearing before them. We have two APAC delegations, which are here this week. The Democrats on the one hand, the Republicans on the other hand, staying in different hotels, not really doing much together. There's a lot happening, right?
They're both giving interviews to the Jerusalem Post.
Well, that's, so of course.
The bipartisan support for the Jerusalem Post is a strategic asset.
Is a strategic asset. And I've always viewed the Jerusalem Post as being the paper that brings everyone together. And I'm glad that we're able to do that. But it just seems like there's so much happening right now as we speak. And I think that the most interesting, at least, that I've been thinking a lot about, and I know you have too, and I think it would be interesting for our listeners to get your perspective on, is Israel's position of what it's trying to attempt of neutrality when it comes to the Russia-Ukraine war, right? And just to explain that to our listeners, Israel, on the one hand, close ally of the United States. The Biden folks ask Israel to be on board with whatever sanctions, whatever punitive measures they're going to put in place against Vladimir Putin. Israel's going to have a tough time saying no. On the other hand, Russia is our neighbor to the north. How do we, because they're in Syria, in control of Syria, how do we manage this, Lahav?
So, first of all, I mean, today I was talking to someone in Lapid's office and they really like took umbrage with the term neutrality. They were like, we're not neutral. That Israel has, you know, clear values and ideas, and Israel's for liberal democracy and against, you know, invading other countries. And so Israel's not neutral. But they're not saying that in public per se. I mean, the public stance, right, has just been talking about evacuating Israelis and helping Jews if they need it, which at the moment, not many Jews are seeking to make aliyah from Ukraine, but a few have. And just that. And the reason is because, well, there's two things that Lapid cites. The first thing Lapid cites are really the large Jewish community in Ukraine, which depending on how you count it is anywhere from 50,000 to 200,000 people. You know, depending on whether you count patrilineal descent or not. You know, there's also a very, very large Jewish community in Russia. I believe it is the second largest diaspora community after the United States. And so that, you know, things are very sensitive because of that. And then in addition to that, of course, we de facto have a border with Russia. I mean, because Russia is the dominant force in Syria, right, on our northern border. And Israel, of course, coordinates. I think we mentioned this last week or the week before that, you know, when Israel seeks to strike an Iranian target in Syria, which happens fairly often, Israel calls the Russian army and tells them, you know, get out of our way. And Russia doesn't like this per se, but they play along with it. And without Russia's cooperation, we could be in trouble. And so taking those practical matters in mind, Israel is treading extremely cautiously and has not taken, at the time of this recording, Israel has not taken a public stance on the conflict itself, only telling people to evacuate. Israel also moved its embassy from Kiev to Lviv, which is further west. That being said, as we're recording this, I have heard some hints that makes me think that Israel might make some kind of statement condemning Russia's not yet invasion, but, you know, seemingly intention to invade. So I'm being a little cautious here because it could be by the time the podcast comes out, Israel will have said something, but I'm sure that it won't be as robust, let's say, as the statements coming out of Western Europe and the United States, because of all those considerations.
Just two things. First of all, I think that the conversation that you portrayed between Israel and Russia before it strikes in Syria is a little more nuanced than get out of our way. It's you know,
sure.
at the end of the day, we do need Russian permission, right? And if the Russians say, no, you're not attacking, we're not going to let you, we're going to shoot down your aircraft. Obviously, that puts Israel in a very difficult position, and we've managed to maneuver that very successfully over the last few years, is to be able to maintain our operational freedom and still play that game with Russia, with America, and with whoever else we need. I think that, you know, I met with Lapid this week. I interviewed him at the Conference of Presidents on stage, and I asked him this question. And he did say kind of what you said of what you heard from within. I'm reading between the lines, but it makes sense what you said, is that, you know, we have our values and we're going to have to do what our values is. And I understand that to be, okay, if we have to condemn the Russians, we'll condemn the Russians. But also what he said, which I found interesting, is that we've conveyed to the Americans that we have this complicated reality that we're going to have to manage in some way.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. And at the same time, and I wrote about this last week, I think that Israel wants to be seen, and Lapid has specifically talked about this in other contexts, that Israel wants to be seen as a liberal democracy, and its alliances with liberal democracies are strong because of our shared values and not only because of shared interests, you know, and that's beginning with the United States, but continues to any other number of Western democracies and perhaps some non-Western democracies as well. You know, and that is important to Israel, you know, a world that in which the democracies are dominant, in which the United States is dominant, is good for Israel on a, you know, strategic level, but also on a values level. And I do think that, you know, there's this level of sort of great powers competition happening between the U.S. and China, and Russia would like it to be happening between the U.S. and Russia. Economically, they're not such a great power, but they do have a huge military.
Right.
And it's increasingly looking like the world is going to be split into two camps. And when it comes to China, Israel's sort of playing the same game, right? We're going to do business with China. But when the Americans pressure us to like cool it a bit, so then we'll take a step back, you know? And I think that we're reaching a time in which the response is going to have to be a bit more robust, and that Israel's going to have to make it clearer that it is in the American camp.
I think we're going to have to make that clear, but we also have to ensure that we retain operational freedom in the North. And I don't know how Israel does that. I think that, you know, Putin could decide that, oh, you're with the Americans now, forget about it. Or if we have some way to explain that to Putin. So, we are a small player in this whole battle, but it does have direct consequences on us because we're kind of like the Baltic states, right? Russia is a neighbor of ours. We're not just another country in the Middle East. Russia sits and controls Syria, and that puts Israel in something of a bind. I wonder also, Lahav, if there is a war between Russia and Ukraine, what does that do to the 5 minutes before midnight that we were speaking about, of when it seems like they're about to reach a deal with Iran? A bad deal, a weaker deal, a shorter deal, not a stronger, not a longer deal, but a deal. And if there is a war, does the world have the bandwidth to be able to manage both of these big diplomatic issues at the same time?
So first of all, I have to say, if we're talking about the doomsday clock, I was looking at their website and everything is about Ukraine and climate change and nothing is about Iran, which shows that I find that organization to be a bit of a joke. But in any case, I do think that the world's sort of attention is turning away from the Iran talks. And it wasn't so much on the Iran talks before that either. It's not getting nearly as much attention as it did in 2015. And that's not good for Israel because my assessment of the situation is that we're now getting to a point where people just want to get it over with because there's another crisis to handle. And getting it over with is not a good strategy for getting a robust deal. Now, Israel is not happy with where things are headed. And contrary to some people, Ben Rhodes want to present to it, it's not like, you know, there's a big camp in Israel that thinks that returning to the JCPOA is like a great idea. It's just not, because there's only 2.5 years left until the major restrictions on Iran end, you know, and everyone who matters from Gantz to Bennett is concerned that the U.S. has not made the deal longer and stronger in any way.
Now, this week, Bennett presented at the Conference of Presidents three different areas where Iran is making demands. And those are the areas in which Israel is sort of putting pressure and talking to the countries that are involved in the talks to try to make the deal not extra weak, let's put it that way, not less strong than it would be by just going back to the JCPOA. So one is that the Iranians want the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, to be taken off of the U.S. terror list. And the IRGC being the force that trains and funds terrorists all across the Middle East. Like when we talk about Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the Houthis, like these are all people with extremely strong IRGC ties. So, you know, the idea of removing their terrorist designation is appalling to Israel. And so Israel's really, really coming out against that. And then the other thing is that there is an International Atomic Energy Agency investigation of suspected nuclear sites in Iran, undeclared nuclear sites and military aspects of their nuclear program. And the Iranians have sort of cooperated on and off. They're not very cooperative, but they want that investigation closed. And Gantz especially has been focused on this. He spoke about the Munich Security Conference, and justifiably so, because you can't fly blind about the Iranian nuclear program. You know, the idea that this investigation should be closed just because there's a deal, I mean, then we don't know what's going on with their nuclear program. We don't have eyes on the ground. So those are the big things that Israel wants to make sure don't end up being in the deal. But it remains to be seen. I mean, that's what Iran is demanding. And I think that by the end of this month, we'll probably have a deal. I mean, we're really closing in on the final days. And certainly in Jerusalem, the estimate is that there will be a deal.
Yeah, I mean, and Ben Rhodes is a real expert, right? I love he always knew better what Israel needed to do than what Israelis thought Israel should do.
He had this whole tweet thread this week about like, oh, there's so many Israeli experts who think that leaving the deal was a mistake. And then he links to J Street, which of course J Street is, you know, they have a specific position. It's not an unbiased source. And the thing that a lot of these experts say, because I have heard them beyond the two-line quote that J Street pulls out for their purposes, is that they say the problem with pulling out was that there was no alternative plan, right? And I agree, that is a real shortcoming of Netanyahu, you know, and Trump. And Netanyahu wasn't the only thing that convinced Trump, but he was part of it. And then there was no follow-up, right? That is a weakness, but that doesn't make the JCPOA a good deal.
No, I think it doesn't make the JCPOA is definitely not a good deal from a resource perspective. The fact that the deal will go back into effect and the sunset clause of 2025 will remain, which is just around the corner, is also very bad. And I think that Israel is ultimately caught with its pants down because it pushed Trump to get out of the deal. There was nothing to fill that vacuum. This government, which came into office, the Bennett-Lapid government, said that we will work together with the administration. We'll be able to get some benefit out of that. Well, that doesn't seem to have happened. And I've heard the IRGC thing. It sounds nice, but come on. I mean, that's cosmetics.
No, of course. It's surrounding, like, last minute.
Exactly. And it's not the big issue. The big issue is the fact that they're going to have sanctions, basically all restrictions removed in 2025, which is around the corner. So if anyone thinks that there's a deal and everything's going to be good, no, it's not all going to be good. And Iran is not suddenly going away. And this issue is going to remain a hot one for Israel for years to come still.
And the other thing, by the way, about the JCPOA, which is when it happened in 2015, everyone talked about the snapback sanctions, that if Iran violates the deal, you could do snapback and they will have all the sanctions on them again. But that's a joke. I mean, we saw what happened when they violated the deal and then the United States tried to do snapback. Now, it's true the United States had left the deal, but none of the other countries that remained in the deal wanted to snap back sanctions, even as Iran, you know, they're now enriching uranium to 60%, which is more than any country that doesn't have nuclear weapons has ever done. So it's not reassuring at all.
Yeah. One day we will all look back at this and say this was a strategic national failure of the state of Israel in the whole way this was handled.
That's interesting that you're saying. I mean, we didn't succeed, right? Like, clearly this didn't end up the way we wanted it to. But I don't know what we could have done.
I'm not talking about right now. I'm talking about the entire way this was handled going back to 2015, 2014. I've become a believer to an extent of yes, Israel can still cause damage. Israel can attack. Israel can do sabotage. Israel can get a lot done, and there will be a price to be paid. And I think it can be effective militarily, even to an extent, and it can buy some time. But there's a huge difference. We've spoken about this before. If you look at the Iraqi model, if you look at the Syrian model, those were reactors being built for those countries by a foreign entity, France in Iraq, North Korea in Syria. This is Iranian technology. This is Iranian knowledge. So you can destroy something, and Iranians who have it, the knowledge, because it's their knowledge, they'll be able to rebuild it. So the most, you're not even just setting them back is going to be for a limited amount of time. But I put that aside. I think that we might have missed the opportunity to attack. I'm not sure. I don't know for sure. But what I do know is that this was not managed right. And I think that Israel has a problem that this speaks to of, in general, having a clear strategy and vision of where do we want to be, where do we want to go. You know, I'll give you another example from completely a different field. This week, you mentioned Benny Gantz's speech at the Munich Security Conference. So Benny Gantz gives a speech, and he talks about the two-entity solution. And I was like, what? Where Israel's not a state anymore? We're an entity? You know, why can't Benny Gantz say...
We're the Zionist entity. Don't you read the Arab press?
For the Iranians, we're the Zionist entity and a cancerous tumor that should be eradicated, of course. But like, you know, I just think about this for a moment. We're coming up on our 74th year. We're almost 75 years old as a country, right? I mean... Can't we be mature about these discussions that we have? You know, you got people who want one state, people who want two states. We have a prime minister who talks about an autonomy on steroids. Now we have a defense minister who's talking about the two-entity solution. I mean, come on. Like, so what do you guys want? And they can't figure it out. And I just think that, you know, there needs to come a point where we decide who we are, what we want, what's our vision that applies to the Palestinians, that applies to the Iranians, that applies to Israeli-Arab integration, it applies to the Negev where there's no law and order, it applies to the draft of the Haredim. I mean, there's a million topics here, and we just keep on...
Yeah.
You know, throwing up something in the air and saying, okay, let's see where it lands.
No, it's definitely
frustrated. I'm frustrated today.
To bring us back to Russia and Ukraine, I feel like we're looking at the short term and not the long term. You know, that it's true that the situation with Russia and Syria is complicated, but I think that that's a short term problem. And in the long term, if we're moving towards a Cold War-esque situation, We need to think in the long term where we want to position ourselves.
Lahav, I have a serious question. Mm-hmm. Can you give I ask for an honest answer, please? Okay. Have you watched the show The Rafaelis?
I have not. I watched like a 5-minute interview with them, but that's about it.
So to our listeners who don't know, Rafaelis is basically, it's like Keeping Up with the Kardashians, right? But this time for the Bar Rafaeli family, right? The famous Israeli supermodel.
Right.
What is that show about? What is that? I mean, I kind of watched a trailer for it the other day. I'm like, what is this? Why is there a show like this being made for Israeli television?
Well, because the local...
You're much more plugged in to culture than I am.
Well, I mean, this is a joke, but I'm saying the local version of the Real Housewives is no longer on the air. So now we need a local version of the Kardashians. You know what? In Israel, like the most popular shows are cooking shows and singing contests. That's like, frankly, I don't really watch either. So hard for me to answer that question.
I barely watch any of this stuff, except I did see last week that Dudi Amsalem, the member of Knesset, who probably... has the most vile rhetoric in the Israeli parliament today, in the way he speaks about almost anything, won the VIP MasterChef show. I guess he's a good cook. Is that like a known thing?
It kind of is a known thing because like there's this concept in Israel, like a parliament, which is sort of like when you get a big group of friends together, like regularly, like say every Friday morning, Friday being the weekend in Israel, to like have coffee together and whatever. And he's known to like host a big one and to like cook for people or whatever. He's also a widower. So I think like he had to cook for his children for a long time. So he has experience. He did win. He's
he's like very, very warm when he likes people. And then when he doesn't like people, he's just completely obnoxious. And I think, I don't know if you were planning to get to this, but, you know, he got up in the Knesset and he said some things about the, I don't remember the exact quote, but he talked about the Supreme Court president, Esther Chayut, and basically like said that she doesn't like people who are, you know, named Amsalem or Makhlouf and, you know, listed a bunch of other sort of North African sounding last names. Chayut herself, I believe, is Moroccan. Or her parents came from Morocco, and she was actually very taken aback by his rhetoric against her. And she wrote like a letter to him, which she also published, which is, you know, sort of a rare thing for Supreme Court justice to do, and said that, you know, she grew up in a Ma'bara, which is sort of like a slum almost, you know, it's sort of like these neighborhoods that, immigrants and mostly immigrants from North Africa and the Middle East were shoved into.
She herself is not Mizrahi. She's Ashkenazi, but her family did spend time in the Ma'bara, and you know, that's where she did grow up with a lot of these Makhlouf, Amsalems, and people who were of Sephardic descent. But my point is like, you know, why did I bring this up? Because so Barrafelli's mother recently came out of jail. Right, where she went for tax evasion. Barrafelli herself was convicted of also tax something or other. And she stayed out of jail.
Right, and that was the thing, that her mother took the jail sentence basically so that Barrafelli wouldn't have to go to jail.
Correct. And
something like that. There was some kind of deal, yeah.
So now culturally, we are celebrating them. At the same time, Dudi Amsalem, who speaks in a way that I find to be revolting about the judiciary in this country... now we're celebrating him.
Or just about Ashkenazim in general. You know, like, I'm not someone who's going to cry and say it's reverse racism against Ashkenazim and whatever, because I think we're overall okay. But there is this, like, cultural phenomenon of, like, mocking Ashkenazim for being, like, all kinds of things, but basically being lame and elitist. And he, like, does that in the Knesset every day.
Yeah, I guess there's a part of me, I was watching this part, the trailer for this show shortly after I had watched Dudi Amsalem's speech. I'm just saying, and seen that he won MasterChef VIP. And I'm like, can't we come up with different heroes for the youth, for society?
Don't get me started on Eyal Golan.
Yeah, another one. Seriously. Yeah. I mean, what he does with young women. I mean, something's wrong. Something's wrong here, I feel. I don't know. That's just me venting.
I think that it's just like throughout Western culture, and then we have our own
take on
unfortunate
it.
Copies of it. Yeah.
So Lahav, who our interview this week is with Polly Bronstein. Why don't you tell our listeners who she is?
Well, that's actually a good transition from us talking about like Dudi Amsalem's ugly rhetoric, because Polly Bronstein, she used to be the head of V15, which was like a political activist organization whose goal was to topple Netanyahu in the 2015 election. And if we talk about it in the interview, they were accused of taking money from the Obama administration, which is not completely accurate. Again, we talked about it in the interview, but, you know, so they sort of became accused of being like foreign actors intervening in the election. And then after Netanyahu won, they turned their organization into something called Dalkeinu, which means like our way. They still wanted to topple Netanyahu, but they were trying to show that they were like they wanted to represent a coalition of people from right to left and not just be a left-wing organization. Now, Polly Bronstein, she oversaw that transition, and she saw it as something sort of tactical. It wasn't that she was no longer left-wing, but over time she drank the Kool-Aid and she realized that being moderate and compromising is a good way forward for politics. And she's now actually written a book about it.
Right.
And the book is in Hebrew, not English, but I found the topic to be very interesting and the way she speaks about it to be very interesting. And so we invited her onto the show.
And to talk about that journey of what it meant to go from what appeared to be the far left to now the center, where things tend to be a little more complicated. So stay tuned for a really interesting interview with Polly Bronstein. So we're excited to have with us Polly Bronstein. Polly is the former head of what was once upon a time known as V15, then it became known as Darkanu, organization that was pretty much, I would say, firmly on the left side of the Israeli political map. And recently, the reason we're speaking today is because Polly has come out with a new book, which I would say is translated from what she told us, is translated from the Hebrew into English. It's not yet out in English. We'll find out if it's coming out. How I Became a Moderate. It's basically about her personal journey from being on the left side of the map to moving towards the center. She's also the executive director of a new initiative called the 100 Initiative, which looks at ways to think about and for Israel to grow the center. So, Polly, it's great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Hi, Aloha. Thank you for having me.
So I'm curious, you know, as we start here, if you could really just kind of give us where the book came from and what's behind the book? What's the message that you're trying to get across? Because it is an interesting journey after all.
Well, I find it very interesting. It was interesting to go through this. So I think it's a very personal, but a very political Israeli story. And the book itself also talks about, you know, what it was like to grow up and be on the left side of Israel, kind of the history of Israel in the past 40 years from a left perspective. But I think it's interesting for me to start with what happened to me after the 2015 election. Because on the 2015 election, I was, a key player, I would say that. Because 3 months before the election, when the government fell, Netanyahu's government fell, and he declared election, I started a campaign called V15. That was, I think, the first ever big magnitude get out the vote campaign in Israel. So it was the first time that there was a civil movement that came out of, I'd say, nowhere, because we were really just a bunch of people, you know, organizing this very civic attempt to overthrow Netanyahu by going door to door where people from the left and center lived and try to get them out to vote. So creating this very massive database of leftists and people who want to replace the government and make sure that on the day of the election, they come out and vote in big numbers. And the aim was at 5%, right? We thought that if we can raise the percentage of voting, the turnout, in the center-left campaign of Israel by 5%, then we will have another government and Netanyahu will no longer be prime minister. And now I want to also add that the reason we were doing this campaign, well, the reasons were various. So some of us were, you know, people of a two-state solution, and we felt that Netanyahu is freezing negotiation with the Palestinians. And some of us came out because of it's the socio-economical reasons, kind of like the later effect of the 2011 protest, social protest. And some of it were just leftists. And Netanyahu was running a very conservative right-wing policies. But bottom line, what happened to me was that after, you know, a big movement arose from this campaign, it was huge. In Israeli numbers, it was just, I think, unprecedented. In terms of, we had 15,000 volunteers all across Israel going door to door canvassing. And we had a database in 3 months of 250,000 Israelis and a very big Facebook page and a lot of donors. It got a lot of traction also because we were attacked severely, I would say, by Netanyahu and his followers and his newspaper, Israel Hayom, and so on.
So I actually want to ask you, just put a pin sort of there. The big thing that people were saying at the time in 2015 was that it was foreign funding. It was the Obama administration's intervention to get Netanyahu out of office, because the organization that you had previously headed or had sort of morphed into V15 did receive funding from, I believe it was the State Department, to promote a two-state solution. So could you tell us sort of what the situation was with that? Were you funded by the Obama administration? Yes.
Who gave you the money?
Of course.
We want to know where the money came from.
Thank you. I love that you're asking this still. And I also obviously touch that in my book. And I at a certain point in the book, I say let's talk about the funding of V15, because you guys will not be able to move forward before I answer this question. So I thank you for asking. So obviously, V15's money was 100% private money from private donors, all Jewish, all Zionists, I want to say, Brits, Americans, Canadians, and Israelis, that their philanthropic portfolio includes the Jewish Agency and Keren Hayesod and Hashomer HaChadash and the Birthright and other very Zionist, I think, missions. What you said, Lahav, I think was part of the delegitimization campaign run by the Prime Minister back then against V15, saying that this is Obama's money, that Obama sent his advisors to overthrow Netanyahu. I want to say, because I wrote the book in hindsight, obviously I'm also critical towards what we did. And, you know, kind of some of it is like it's like a soul search. Where were we wrong? But I want to say in that angle, I believe 2015 was a dramatic moment in Israeli politics in terms of the fact that Netanyahu, I think, decided to put aside, I would say, centrism and mamlachtiyut, or being like the prime minister of everyone. Mm-hmm. And he used V15 in a very aggressive way to bring his base out to vote. So together, I want to say, Netanyahu and V15, we managed to raise percentage of voting in Israel by 5% all over Israel in that election. So it was a peak of, I think, almost 73% of population, of people with rights to vote, came out to vote. And I was devastated that he won, and he won big. That's easy, right? Because we didn't see it coming. Mm-hmm. We were in our own bubble. And in my own bubble and our own bubble, nobody voted for Netanyahu. And we were winning in our social media, in our feeds, right? In our reality, we were winning. Everyone was with us. We were, and Netanyahu, that was very, very aggressive against us, was obviously about to lose. So what happened? The day after the election, I wake up, like literally the day after the election, and I ask myself, what don't I understand about Israel? What does the left get wrong about Israelis, about what motivates them, about what they want? Why do they vote for Netanyahu when he is obviously, that's how I saw it then, right? He's obviously wrong. We're all obviously right. Why is he winning and we're losing? That was the point where things have started to change for me. Mm-hmm. Cool. On one hand, I had this huge movement. The movement did not have a cause because the elections were over and we lost. So first of all, we had to think whether we're keeping this movement alive, and if so, what will be its goals? What will be its mission? But I knew that I don't want to do the obvious, which has become this opposition movement to Netanyahu. I wanted to be smarter. I wanted to understand.
Wait, is it smarter, Pauly, though, or is it also recognition of reality? It's being a realist. It's understanding that if you can't beat them, join them to an extent, or realizing that maybe the extremes don't work. We're so used to the polarization and the division that so few people are willing to say. And I think what's interesting also about what you are saying in the book is that you're not, you know, very often we see people who go from the far left to the far right, right? Or we see people who go from the far right to the far left. It's a little more rare to see people who say, listen, being extreme might not work. I'm going to be a centrist.
So I want to be very honest here and to say the point where I started the journey was a very tactical point. So I just lost the election. I realized we don't have the numbers. We will never win if we continue doing what we're doing. And I wanted to find another strategy in order to win next time. So what, you know, what I realized was, if we don't have the numbers, let's look for partners on the, I would say, we say soft right or moderate right. Let's climb over the wall that separates left and right and try to find partners on the other side so we can make our camp broader and we can win next time. So it was very tactical. The thing is, what happens to you when you decide really to soul search and ask for look for answers, and you start listening, then you change. And that was a moment where I remember telling my partners in my movement, I was saying, listen, if we want the people on the right to change so they will be more like us, we will also need to change, right? If we go door to door now, knocking on doors of people who voted for Netanyahu, who are obviously not in our camp now, but we want to have a dialogue, so maybe we can find like middle ground, so next time we can win together. If we want to convince them, we also need to be influenced by them. And that was the moment where I realized not everyone's like me, right, on the left. not everyone's like me anywhere. So I think people don't like changing, obviously. Most people, it's hard. Changing is hard, and realizing that you don't hold all the truth on your side and that your perspective is just one of many, that's not an easy thing. And so I remember going from to listen to right-wing journalists, to right-wing politicians, to running like focus groups of right-wing, and keep listening and learning a lot of stuff, going back to my camp, to the left, and saying, oh my God, you have to listen to this. This is what I found out. This is what we're doing wrong. This is where we're wrong. And more, I started feeling like the left is not willing to change. Even though it was a losing camp, right? Even though it was obvious that what it's doing is wrong, it just continues to shrink. At a point, you know, it fell to the number of 10 seats in the Knesset, which was unprecedented. But still, they didn't want to listen. And so my journey made me go further and further away until to a point where I felt that I don't belong there anymore in the left.
So first of all, I appreciate your honesty, because I, as I mentioned before the interview, I interviewed you when V15 turned into Darkanu. I interviewed you for the Jerusalem Post. And frankly, I didn't really believe you. Like, I felt like it was a way of trying to convince people that V15 isn't right wing, but that ultimately the goal was the same thing.
Right.
And I mean that V15 wasn't left wing, but that the goal was the same thing. So I guess I'm interested in what the reactions were, because you were in this organization that was very solidly left wing, and then just trying to look at the center. Like, how did people accept your vision? You know, and what is the reaction within the political camp that you were such a part of?
Right. So that is what the book describes mainly. It starts from the left, and I think it's interesting for people who are right wing to hear the part that describes how it was for me in the left, because then you get to understand what are the worries and what are the concerns and why is the leftist the way is? What is that camp the way it is? Obviously, the left is not wrong about everything. It's not only condescending. It has its fears and it has its values and so on. So that's one part. The third part, which is the last part, is what you talk about, is what my experiences with my own camp. I think the peak of it was when I ran in 2017 for the first time the Rabin Memorial Rally in Rabin Square. Mm. The movement, Darkenu, and we decided that if we're going to do that, we're going to do it very differently than before. So we're going to open Rabin Square to everyone, and we're going to invite on stage settlers and Haredis and Arabs and people from the right wing. And we're going to actively say this cannot be the synagogue of the left on his Yom Kippur, which is the day of Rabin's murder memorial. This has to be everyone's. You know, I'll tell you something interesting. You know that Israel is divided between four different educational streams, right? The Arabs go to the Arab education, and the Haredis go to the Haredi education, and the religious to the religious, and secular to the Mamlachti, the secular stream. So our kids are growing up here as if it were four different states, right? Because nothing is the same. We don't have any joint core between the four streams. So here's an example. The Rabin's murder and its lessons are not taught in any of the streams but the secular one. And it shook me to the core. So here's something that everyone in Israel needs to learn about and understand. You know, what can happen if we act violently, if we decide to put democracy aside, how it will destroy us, how we have to stick to the rules of the game and to our joint values and so on. But the settlers will not teach about it. The Arabs will not teach about the Haredi. It's like the left is keeping Rabin's memory and the murder's lessons alone. And so we went to the rally knowing that we are going to actively reach our hand and say, come, people on the right wing that have are not dealing with it because they feel that they're being accused of the murder, come to the square and become part of it. And what we didn't realize is that we didn't have the mandate to do that. It's like the left has, you know, acquired, it bought that day and that place for the memorial and will not, you know, host anyone else in the square. And so when we announced that settlers are going to be on stage, all hell broke loose. It was the most, instead of Rabin's Memorial Day being like a day of together and unity around something that we all agree on, it became a war. And I was in the middle.
What year was that?
That was 2017. And it mm-hmm. happened again in 2018 mm-hmm. when we hosted the rally again. And it was worse.
Polly, when you look at the political map, and I was reading one interview that you gave to Macori Shon, which is known for being a pretty right-wing newspaper that serves, let's say, the settler camp. And you spoke there about the need for the left to learn from the right when it comes to Jewish tradition, when it comes to even the idea of what fear is for the right. The left also needs to take some of that. And you spoke about the left, how it's maybe overly optimistic and how they look too much at the right as being the enemy, as being their enemy when they're really not. You spoke about the Oslo Accords and the mistakes that were made there when Rabin and Peres weren't taken into consideration how the settler camp would respond to all this. I'm just curious, like if you look now from 30,000 feet out at the Israeli political map, what would you like to see? Like if you could break it down in terms of separation or where the camps should be, what should be the dividing line? Like how does it look from there for you?
So the way I see it today, neither the left or the right in Israel and in the world, I think, doesn't have good enough answers to meet the very complex challenges that we're facing today. I think left and right are ideologies from the 20th century, and we are deep in the 21st century, just surrounded by very, very complicated, full of contradiction reality that if you only see it from one side, if you try to look at the challenges that we have, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, religion and state, and the Netanyahu trial, if you only take that from an ideological right-wing or left-wing perspective, you fail. You don't have, your vision is, you're blind. And so if you're asking, what do I want to see? I want to see a new Israeli paradigm. I think the new Israeli paradigm should come from the center. And when I say center, I'm not talking partisan, right? I'm talking about this, I would say this narrative, this core in the middle, which I think we should reinvent in a way that is relevant for Israel today and the complexities that it has today. And it should take from the left and it should take from the right, but it should also create a synthesis, right? A new story. And I want to also say a political statement here. This government that we have today that is called the change government by some, I guess mm-hmm. some will not call it that way. For me, this is something that I've been saying for many years. I know a lot of people look at it as, they had no choice, or it's the anti-Netanyahu government. And perhaps they didn't join together because of ideology. Obviously, they didn't, right? They did it only to avoid a fifth election or to get rid of Netanyahu or whatever. I think the change government should become its a new story. if we can have people from the left and the right and the center and Arabs and Haredis, by the way, I want to say, and Haredis, sit together in the same government, making the pragmatic compromise necessary to run the country in a way that is much more, I would say, down to earth, but with an Israeli story in the middle, that everyone is represented in that story and can give us a joint vision. I can give you, by the way, examples of how I think this should look. But if you're asking me where I think this needs to go, I think this government needs to say out loud very clearly, this government is not something that we did because we didn't have a choice. This is the answer. This is the government that should take us to the future. This is how governments from now on should look in Israel. Not only a joint story, but also a wider one. So that's what's wrong with this government. It's very narrow. And when it's very narrow, each of the players in coalition has too much power, right? I don't think any group in Israel should hold so much power. If you run a centrist game, then everyone's invited, right? If you run a centrist game, then Haredis are invited if they're willing to share the joint Israeli new paradigm. Same with Arabs, same with settlers, everyone. But nobody holds power to hold a government hostage. So that's what I would change in the change government.
So this government, you know, on the one hand, it represents a very broad swath of the Israeli population, and it's diverse, and it definitely celebrates its own diversity a lot of, you know, often. But at the same time, it's almost paralyzed in many, many areas and important areas, whether it's, you know, in the diplomatic field. I mean, you have experience advocating for a two-state solution. It's definitely paralyzed when it comes to anything, when it comes to the Palestinians. But also in other areas, you know, there's huge disputes over the economy, over, you know, how to handle issues with the Bedouins in the Negev. That's been a big one, and citizenship laws, you know, immigration laws. It's very hard to get anything done when you have left and right and nobody agreeing. So how do you think those two things can work together to have a diverse government, but also an effective government?
So Lav, first of all, let me argue that I don't think former governments of Israel, not the one that Netanyahu led between 2015 and 19, was more effective or less frozen or did more reform or was able to implement its policies. So I think a lot of people in the right will tell you that Netanyahu had the government and it was wide enough and it was all only right wing and he could get a lot of things done when it comes to right wing ideology, and he didn't. So governments are hard, right? And politics are hard always. So saying about this government, because of its, you know, diversity, that it's unable to be effective, I don't know. So far, I've seen it done some very impressive things for a government that said at the beginning that it's only there to, you know, make sure that there's a new budget and that we don't have a fifth election, and the expectations from it were very, very low. Let me give you a new political paradigm. Okay. I envision a new Israeli story in the center, coming in the center, very open, very willing to, you know, to have a dialogue with all parts of the country. And it brings out a ruling party of 35 seats. Okay. I imagine it coming from the center, but it can also come from right wing, or it can also also be Likud, but it needs to be centrist. It needs to be pragmatic. And when you have a party like that, a ruling party of 35 that comes from the center, it is free. In what sense is it free? It doesn't go immediately. Once the election is over, it doesn't go immediately to its block. It doesn't have a block. Mm-hmm. It doesn't immediately go to the right or to the left. It says, we're open to everyone. This is these are our core values, our core Israeli values. And I want to say, first of all, Jewish and democratic, right? A balance between a Jewish state and a democratic state. Now come and join us. And we are aiming at a 70 and 80 seat coalition. And when you're free, you turn to the left. The left says, we will not join you with, you know, for these values. Say, okay, fine. I'm going to the right. And the right says, I will only join you like this. Say, okay, I have many options. So I am looking for a government. We had a, when we were looking at polls prior to elections in the past, we would see a left block and a right block. And do you remember what happened when we only had left and right? All of a sudden, Lieberman left the right-wing block and he said, I will no longer be counted there. Count me as free. And all of a sudden you had a left block, a right block, and Lieberman. And then you had Gideon Saar again saying, I'm right-wing, but I will not sit with Netanyahu. And you had Bennett saying, we will not support Netanyahu automatically. We will recommend ourselves for prime minister. You started seeing this break between. So what do I envision? I envision a total, you know, ruin of the block system, of the left and right, you know, paradigm. And I would say, bring us a free, centrist, new Israeli party paradigm story and have it play on all the field. And I think if you play all the field, you can score more goals.
I understand what you're saying, and it sounds like a utopia. I mean, I've always viewed myself, and maybe Lahav can argue, I don't know, but I've always felt that being in the center is really it's the most difficult place also to be, because things are not black and white. I've always looked at people who, some of them writers for the paper, op-ed columnists, contributors, who I've, in other places as well, who are so they know the truth and they're so passionate about the truth. They know what we need to do. They know who's right. They know who's wrong. And I think that when you're in the center, it's really complicated because it's not black and white. It's gray. Sometimes you can lean right. Sometimes you lean left. Sometimes you're uncertain and you don't have the answer, and you debate within yourself. And I think that that's a great place to be, but it's also, I don't know how sustainable it is. Like, I look at this government, for example, which we were just talking about, and yeah, they're able to get stuff done. They're able to focus on, you know, I was talking with one of Yair Lapid's people the other day. I called it the 70-30. They're able to focus on the 70% and they put aside the 30%. He said, no, it's 80 and 20. I said, what does it make a difference? Right? 80, 20, 70, 30, it's all the same. but the bottom line is that that works for a period of time, but that 30%, that 20%, it festers and it gets to you and it annoys you at some point. And then it takes over. And then it might not last. So how sustainable is it?
First of all, I totally agree with you. And I can tell you on a personal, from a personal perspective, being, and people think, they tell me, right? They write comments on the stuff that I write and they write back, you have no spine. You just want everyone to like you. So I want to say it's the other way around, right? Everyone hates me. When you decide that you, I was attacked from the right in a very, very aggressive way that really, you know, it touched my cord. Because it attacked my Zionism, my devotion to the country, how loyal I am to Israel. That's my soft spot, right? But I was also attacked from the left very aggressively in recent years, which was also very painful because that's the camp I came from. That was the home, my home. That's where I was supposed to feel safe. So from a personal perspective, I want to tell you, yeah, being in the center is very, very hard. But also, another personal thing I want to say, I'm a very passionate person, right? I have opinions. Some will say I'm too opinionated, right? I have my red lines that I will not cross. There are values that I will die for, literally. So I'm not spineless, it's not that I don't have an opinion, but I'm very pragmatic. What I assume is that if I am willing to compromise on one value, I can get a win in another. I'm very tactical that way. I think that's the center.
Right.
I think an extremist, Jacob, an extremist has many values, not just one, but he does have one that all the rest of them bow to.
Right.
Right. If for example, a hardcore settler will tell you, you know, for the Eretz Israel, for the settlement, you know, I'm willing to put aside everything else that matters to me. Including, human dignity, human rights, and so on. I am not like that. I have many values, and sometimes I choose to put this first and sometimes the other. So I understand what you're saying, that it's hard, and what I'm saying is a utopia, but let me suggest that this government gives a lot of hope to people like me, right? Because when they had a cause, and obviously the cause was, you know, making sure that Netanyahu doesn't assemble a government, or that there's not another election, so on. But they were able to put aside, look at Mansour Abbas, head of RAM. The things that come out of this man's mouth in recent months are super brave. And they're changing things. Now, I don't know if it will change in one government, but he started something. I'm looking at Matan Kahana, for example. I think he's a brave right-wing leader. I look at Yair Lapid and the compromises he made in order to sit in this government. Sure. So even Ayelet Shaked, that people criticize, you know, how she's very hardliner inside the government. Still, people are putting aside some of the things that are important to them in order to bring achievements. I don't think it's a utopia. I think people had enough from the extremes. On the other hand, I want to say it can go either way, right? We're in a moment in time that there's an opportunity. I want to say it's here, it's in the UK, it's in Europe, it's in the United States, everywhere. It can go either way. We can become more extreme, more divided. It can end up in wars inside democracies, wars of democracies against democracies, like what we see, or states versus states like we see in Ukraine and Russia. But it can also bring a new era where people got to see how scary it is, that we, the slippery slope, right? November
6th. January 6th,
At the Congress and so on, January 6th. And then they go back and say, no. We are willing to compromise in order to keep our democracies, keep our states, keep our, you know, our lives.
Right, right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Polly, for coming on the podcast. It's been very interesting. You have an interesting voice against polarization. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. And hopefully I will have an English version so your listeners can also read, not just listen.
You'll let us know when that happens. Thank you very much, Polly. Be well.
I will. Thank you.
That's it for this week's podcast. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, the Jerusalem Post podcast is available on iTunes, Spotify, all major podcast platforms. Please send it to your friends and family, and we'll be back next week.